books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today's show is our second look back at some of the standout interviews from 2023. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. On today's show, we'll talk to Charlotte Levin about her book, If I Let You Go. Joe Haddow will tell us that art is everywhere. We'll hear from the winning author of the Yoto Carnegie Medal in 2023, Manon Stephen Ross. But up first, let's visit Victoria Bennett and her book All My Wild Mothers, Motherhood, Loss and an Apothecary Garden.
When I imagined our future, it held no grief. In that wished-for life, my husband and I live in a remote farmhouse with chickens in the doorway, fresh bread rising in the Raeburn, and our many children playing barefoot among the cottage flowers. During the day, I write in my whitewashed studio, and my husband paints at his easel, and at night we share food and conversation with our friends. The reality is not this. What was meant to be our happy ever after has turned out to be our barely hanging on. It has been 4 years since my sister died and my son was born. Since then, I've walked like a ghost mother, broken by grief that wraps itself around me and will not let go.
All My Wild Mothers is my debut memoir, although I've been writing for many years, since I was a child, really, but writing poetry and publishing it for many years. This is my first book with so many words, is what I say to people. So it's my debut memoir, and it was written over a decade of care and grief. So it was written between the hours of those things, and it weaves together herbal folklore, kind of traditional wart cunning medicine, and personal memoir about grief and motherhood, loss, and the physical act of planting a wild apothecary garden with my young son in our new home, which was on a social housing estate in Cumbria, a new built one. And it had been built, the estate had been built over old industrial ground, so we were planting into what was essentially just layers and layers of rubble, because the industrial ground had been a former stonework, so it not only had what had been the industrial buildings underneath the topsoil, but it also had 2 centuries of stoneworks rubble under it as well. And we grew that together on no money, just really with growing what would grow in this ground. And it was really the weeds beneath our feet that grew it. And we learnt together what properties they had and the folklore and the medicinal uses. And we grew food there as well. So it's about what grows, not in spite of what's broken, but because of it.
And what actually made you turn this journey into a book?
I didn't intend it. I think my intention wasn't a book at the beginning. Life was passing by very quickly, and I had been deeply, deeply in grief for the first years of my son's life. And also, I was also a carer for my son, who was diagnosed at the age of 2 with type 1 diabetes and was very, very sick because that had been missed for quite a while. And I decided that in between the care demands and the grief and all the rest of it and just the day-to-day, I wanted to try and put down on paper, put down in words the moments we were having. So I would, whenever I had a moment, I would light a candle and I would sit at my desk and I would write for as long as I had until I was called to do something else. And then I would blow the candle out and I would get back to what I needed to do. And sometimes that was 10 minutes, and sometimes that was 2 minutes, and the chapters vary in length, I think possibly reflecting the way that it was written. And it was about trying to put into words the things that had gone in my life, so because of loss, the things that had passed, and also to capture or to get as close to the moments I was living. And then after a long time, it became a book.
As the politicians talk of tightening our national belt, my husband worries about being a good father, about providing for his family. He's frightened that he will not be able to support us. He says that he should get a real job. I tell him that being an artist is a real job, and what we do matters, that we will survive as we always have. But we don't live in a culture that values what we can give, and it gets harder to do. The work gets less, the pay lower, the distance to travel further. He spends longer away, trading in the days of our son's early years for the hope of security later on. An echo of my own childhood days.
From May of last year, thanks once again to Victoria Bennett. That whole interview can be found in show 320.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
In 2023, the first author I interviewed on the Booker shortlist was Paul Lynch, who went on to win the prize. And the same was true for the Yoto Carnegies. The first author I spoke to won the Carnegie Medal. That was Manon Stephen Ross for her novel, The Blue Book of Nippo.
Mam says it's best to write like this now, because she can't be bothered to teach me, I think. Can't be bothered, or can't find the energy. I'm not sure which it is, or if there's any difference. She used to sit with me for an hour each morning, the hour when Mona sleeps. We did stuff like adding and reading, not like we used to do at school, no graphs or times table or anything like that. She got me to read books, and then I had to write about them, and she marked them with a red biro, telling me where I'd spelled something wrong or said something stupid. And then after doing adding up and taking away, there was no more maths. She started to worry about the biros too, because we don't want them running out. "I don't have anything else to teach you, Dolan," she said yesterday. She'd just read through something I'd written about a romantic novel about a man and a woman who meet on a train, and I think something clicked in her. "There's no point carrying on like this." So she said that, as long as I spend an hour writing every day, she wasn't going to bother me with schoolwork anymore. She got this book from a house we broke into in Nepo. It was in one of the small drawers of a little desk in the corner of someone's living room. Usually we only steal the really important stuff, like matches or rat poison or books. But she held this notebook in her hands and turned it over a few times before putting it in her bag. "You have that," she said later, when we got home, "to write your story. The Blue Book of Nippo."
The Blue Book of Nippo is a novel about a mother and son surviving the end of the world, basically. There's some kind of unnamed nuclear disaster, and there's basically nobody else left around but them. And it's about their survival and about how they survive on a practical level, but also on an emotional level at that age where the son, Dolan, is naturally growing away from his mother, but there's nobody to grow towards because there's nobody left. So it's kind of about the end of the world, but it's also about a mother and son relationship.
And we never actually find out what happened, although there's a maybe a hint of a nuclear something.
Yeah. I think I wanted to keep it that way because on one level, it just made it easier for me on a practical level, you know, so... because nobody really knows what would happen exactly in those kinds of situations. But also I wanted it to be transferable to different kinds of situations. And, you know, I wrote this book in 2017. And since then, I think we've become a lot more eco-conscious. I certainly am. I have a lot more eco-anxiety than I did. And I think maybe if I wrote this book now, I wouldn't have selected the nuclear option, if you like. It would be something else. But I do think it's easily transferable to different kinds of world events.
Yeah, because in the anyone who was born in the 70s or the 80s, the threat of nuclear war or nuclear accident was very real at the time.
Absolutely. And I think that's where this book comes from, really. I remember going to protests and things with my parents, CND, the campaign for nuclear disarmament when I was a child. And then that worries always stayed with me, that fear. And it kind of went away for a little bit when I was a teenager. And then it came back again when I had my own children. And there's a story that my sister remembers, but I can't remember it myself. But there was a sort of, there was a CND protest, and then there was a speaker who'd come to take questions from the children specifically. And somebody had asked this speaker, if there was some kind of accident in the nuclear power plant Wylfa on Anglesey, what would it be like? And the answer was, think about how bad it could be, and it would be worse than that. And apparently I didn't sleep for days after that, because to think that something is worse than your imagination can even come up with, it's just terrifying.
Now, you said this was written in 2017, so this was pre-COVID. This was a book about people self-isolating before we all had to.
Yeah, it was a weird one, because I wrote it originally in Welsh, and it came out in 2018 in Wales. And then COVID came along, and it was a little bit uncomfortable, because people were saying, oh, this is reminding me of Llyfr Glas Nebo, as it's called in Welsh. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, parts of it are just a bit too close for comfort. And especially in the early days when we didn't quite know what we were facing, what was happening. So, yeah, it's quite a weird one, that, because I think it came out exactly the right time. And it was odd because there was a stage adaptation in Welsh by a company called Cymru'r Frânwen. And I remember on the last night, there was a Q&A after the performance, and I was part of the Q&A. And a few people were starting to not shake each other's hands because there was this COVID-19 thing. And I thought at the time, why is he not shaking my hands? This is just ridiculous. This is just nothing. There's nothing going to come of this COVID thing. Of course, I was proven completely wrong. But it was odd that, you know, I think if it would have happened just a little bit earlier, that theatre experience wouldn't have happened. And a lot of people who went to see it in the theatre said that was a really odd way of starting lockdowns, because the week before I'd seen this play about the end of the world and having to feel and be isolated.
Mm-hmm. Now, originally written in Welsh, as you said, did you translate it yourself?
I did, yeah, I did. I really love translation, because I'm Welsh first language, so I was brought up speaking Welsh, and I speak Welsh at home with my own children as well. But English has always been there as well, so I've been fluent in both languages since I can remember. And I really enjoy the process of translation, or maybe adaptation is a better word for it when it comes to creative things. And so I adapted it into English when I didn't have any kind of hopes for it in a way. I just thought, well, I'll do it because it's something that I really enjoy doing. I'll do it just for my own pleasure. And I think that works really well with everything creative, because if you do it for yourself, there's something more authentic about it, and you're not doing it, you're not trying to please everybody, you're not writing for a particular audience. You're writing just for your own pleasure. I think there's something quite pure about doing it that way.
You said adapted. Does that mean it's a different book in the two languages?
Yeah, it is. Because in the Welsh language, it's written in the first person, from the perspective of the two characters, the mother and son. And of course, in the Welsh version, they were writing the Blue Book of Nebo in Welsh. And in the English version, I thought, well, I could either, you know, change the location completely into somewhere where they wouldn't speak Welsh, or I can keep it in the same place in Nepal, but then I have to come up with a reason why they're writing it in English. And so the theme of reclaiming your mother tongue and your own language isn't there so much in the English, in the Welsh version. It's more about people who speak Welsh and don't feel that their Welsh is good enough to write, and it's that kind of thing more in Welsh. So it does feel like quite a different book. And I did change most of the names between two versions. So Rowena is the same, but in the Welsh version, Dylan is Sean, Mona is Dwynwen, because I just wanted it to feel like a different book, I think. I wanted to give myself that license to change it so that it was the best book it could be and not feel too tied to the original. But the name changing didn't really work because I've just confused myself so many times in interviews and so on. I've just said the wrong name and then they don't know what I'm talking about.
Thanks to Manon Stephen Ross, who of course went on to win the Carnegie Medal. You're listening to our Read On review of 2023. And in a moment, Joe Harrell will tell us that art is everywhere. But for now, let's take a journey into the RNIB Talking Books Library and find some new books for January.
We have the biography of Lawrence of Arabia by Ranulph Fiennes, which was kindly donated by Penguin Random House.
In November 1914, following the Ottoman Empire's alliance with the Central Powers of Germany and Austria-Hungary, the British declared war on the Turks. Almost immediately, they began to protect their domains in the Middle East. Of primary concern was defending their oil interests in Basra, while also securing the vital shipping lane of the Suez Canal, which helped bring much-needed supplies from India. As a result, British troops quickly flooded into Egypt, which had been under British occupation since 1882, and there was an urgent need for intelligence officers who knew the Middle East and spoke Arabic. This was how Lawrence came to be in Cairo in late 1914. On paper, at least, he certainly fitted the bill. Indeed, few were better equipped for such a role.
His journey to this point has long been legend, from his first posting as archaeologist, liaison map officer, to fighting alongside guerrilla forces during the Arab Revolt, journeying more than 300 miles through blistering heat to capture Aqaba, to his involvement in peace conferences that decided the future of the Middle East, Lawrence gave over his life fully to this land and its people. An unhappy outsider in childhood in Arabia, Lawrence found a home. But as he grew in notoriety and proved his worth to his Arab comrades, his Turkish enemies set their sights on his capture. A legend in his own lifetime, Lawrence's epic story has always been ripe for the retelling. But Ranulph Fiennes is no ordinary biographer. Leading Arab troops into the battle on the Arabian Peninsula in a war fought 50 years later, Fiennes too discovered the wonders of these far-flung lands and the people who live there, and is one of the very few who can claim a true insight into the kind of life that Lawrence lived, bold and adventurous to the end. With detailed access to records and an in-depth knowledge of the exploration routes and mindset of those to venture into the unknown, in Lawrence of Arabia, Fiennes brings us at last to a true and full account of this mysterious adventure captivated the world.
By October 1916, Lawrence's influence on Arab affairs appeared all but over. Far away from the action, he was instead ordered to fulfil the mundane task of designing a set of postage stamps to reinforce the apparent success of the revolt. While this perceived demotion frustrated him, the death of his brothers Will and Frank on the battlefields of France also plagued him. "They were both younger than I am," he wrote to a friend, "and it doesn't seem right, somehow, that I should go on living peacefully in Cairo." However, when Lawrence learned that Ronald Storrs was due to meet Sherif Hussein's son, Abdullah, in Jeddah, he spotted the opportunity he was looking for. "I decided that I must escape at once," he wrote. "A straight request was refused, so I took to stratagems. I became, on the telephone, quite intolerable to the staff on the Suez Canal. I took every opportunity to rub into them their comparative ignorance and inefficiency in the Department of Intelligence, and irritated them yet further by literary airs, correcting Shavian split infinitives and tautologies in their reports. No doubt happy to see the back of him, Lawrence's request to accompany Stores was finally approved. So, on the 13th of October 1916, Lawrence boarded the Lama, a small converted liner, and began the 650-mile journey to Jeddah, hoping to reignite the revolt, all the while carrying a dark secret with him.
Lawrence of Arabia by Ranulph Fiennes is read by Jonathan Keeble and runs for 8 hours 16 minutes.
For lovers of more medieval warfare, Bloomsbury have gifted us Battle for the Island Kingdom by Don Holway.
The sight would have been terrifyingly familiar to anyone living along the Channel coast in the centuries leading up to the turn of the millennium. That is, anyone lucky enough to have survived it the first time. Longships, high prowed, low in the water, closing in from the horizon with astonishing speed, oars sweeping across a high tide and hulls scraping to a halt on the silty shore. Men in chainmail hauberks and leather burnies, bearing shields and naked blades, leaping over the gunwales into the knee-deep surf to wade onto foreign soil. And soon, the screams of victims and the glower of flames rising from thatched roofs. Except these invaders weren't Vikings. By their leaders' elaborate full-face helmets, their single-edged clip-point swords, and their banners, Roman-style windsocks in the form of golden wyverns, the two-legged winged dragon symbolic of Wessex, they would have shown themselves to be Anglo-Saxons, sent by their king Athelred to punish the Norman Duke Richard II for his flirtation with Vikings.
In a saga reminiscent of Game of Thrones and The Last Kingdom, Battle for the Island Kingdom reveals the life and death struggle for power which changed the course of history. The 6 decades leading up to 1066 were defined by bloody wars and intrigues in which 3 peoples vied for supremacy over the island kingdom. In this epic retelling, Don Holway recounts the clashes of Vikings, Anglo-Saxons and Normans, their warlords and their conniving queens. It begins with the Viking Canute the Great forging 3 nations into his North Sea empire while his Saxon wife rules in his stead and schemes for England's throne. Her archenemy is Emma of Normandy, widow of Saxon King Ethelred, claiming Canute's realm in exchange for her hand in marriage. Their sons become rivals, pawns in their mother's war, until they can secure their own destinies. And always in the shadows is Godwin of Wessex, playing all sides to become the power behind the throne, until his son, Harold, emerges as king of all of England. But Harold's brother Tostig turns traitor, abandons the Anglo-Saxons and joins the army of the last great Viking, Harald Hardrada, where together they meet their fate at the Battle of Stamford Bridge. And all this time, watching from across the water, is William the Bastard, fighting to secure his own Norman dukedom, but with an eye on the English crown.
The 11th century monk William of the Benedictine Abbey at Jubierge in Normandy was born right around the time of this raid and devoted a chapter of his Gesta Normannorum Ducum, Deeds of the Dukes of the Normans, to it. According to him, Athelred had ordered the raiders to lay waste Richard's land with iron and fire. He further commanded them to capture Duke Richard, bind his hands behind his back, and deliver him into the royal presence alive. They had landed on the banks of the Serre River, which winds halfway across the Cotentin Peninsula to its outlet on the east coast. In their shallow draft longships, the Vikings had routinely exploited river routes to penetrate deeply and unexpectedly into enemy territory. The Serre, however, today at least, is more of a winding creek, barely 3 or 4 yards across, deep enough to bear longships, but not wide enough to accommodate the sweep of their oars. And the Anglo-Saxons, as shall be seen, did not have the seagoing Vikings' aversion to long overland marches. They beached on the tidal flats at the river mouth and waded across the rich offshore oyster beds, which are still farmed to this day. The 12th century Norman writer Master Ruys probably used Jumièges as a source for his Roman de Roux, a history of the Norman people. He confirmed, "Disembarking, each tried to outrace the others, and quickly made their way to the beach. They took plunder and food, captured sheep and cattle, and razed and burned houses. Women wept, and peasants fled." The English would find, however, that times had changed in Normandy. The kings of Francia relied on their Norman vassals to repel seaborne invaders, and the Normans took their royal duty seriously.
Battle for the Island Kingdom, England's Destiny from 1000 to 1066 by Don Holloway, is read by John Sackville, and it runs for 15 hours and 40 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Art is Everywhere is the ultimate guide to awesome art in the world around us and the great people making it. Joe Harrow is the author of this inspiring, friendly guide to art and why it matters. You can meet the incredible people making art of all kinds and follow the tips to make your own. If you're listening to this show on the day of release, this book came out in print yesterday, and at the time of recording, it's exclusively available in audio only from RNIB Talking Books. It's read by the author himself.
What is art? That's a big question. Probably too big to start with, actually. Let's try this instead. What do you think art is? I used to think art referred to drawings and paintings and nothing else. Art was something that hung on the walls of galleries and museums, I thought. Well, some art does hang on the walls of galleries and museums, and drawings and paintings are certainly art. But that little word, those three letters, A-R-T, cover so much more than just drawings and paintings. Now when I think of art, I think of music, books, films, dance, poetry, comedy, fashion, photography, TV, and so many other things. Art is everywhere.
Joe Harrow reading from his book Art is Everywhere. He joined me down the line and first told me a bit about his background.
I started working for the BBC in about 2007, I think it was. I was still studying. I was in the last year of university and always knew I wanted to work in radio, always knew it, and managed to land myself a job at the BBC at Radio 2, and I was making tea, pretty good at making tea. And I was answering phones and worked my way up to becoming a producer there. And I had 14 very happy years at the BBC between Radio 2 and 6 Music and 5 Live. And that whole time, I was also interested in other forms of art. I've always thought of myself as a bit of a creative, if I'm honest, and making radio shows, as you know, is very much a creative thing. And being a presenter or a producer or building documentaries or whatever it is that you do in that audio space, you know, I've found is a great, great creative space and a passion of mine. But alongside it, I was dabbling in writing. I was drumming quite a lot, learnt drums when I was 9, and have never wanted to do it as a sort of career, really. I didn't want the drums to turn into my job. I just enjoyed doing it. But I've always played them since I was 9. And I was very lucky to go out on tour with a couple of my very talented friends who are, you know, proper musicians. So I feel like I've, you know, I've done that. I've done the rock and roll thing. But I did that alongside, you know, working at the BBC. I took 6 weeks off. I remember asking my boss if I could have 6 weeks unpaid leave. And they said, yes, why? I said, I'm going on tour with the Waterboys. And I was, technically, but we were the support act. But still, I went on tour with the Waterboys for 6 weeks drumming around the UK. And it was absolutely fab. And then more recently, I've been really interested in visual art. I mean, my dad always made art when I was growing up. In fact, my bedroom is now his art studio. He was a head teacher for many, many years, but he studied art and he's always loved painting. And I think I grew up around his art and around the books that him and my mum had around the house. So I've always loved reading, always loved looking at art. I mean, I cannot paint to save my life personally, but yeah, more recently I've started collecting it and filling my walls with all sorts of wonderful things. And now I am a writer because this is my first book. I'm still working at the BBC. I run the Radio 2 Book Club. I also run a production company who makes podcasts and does lots of wonderful things in the audiovisual space. And I'm clinging on to that rock and roll lifestyle as a drummer. Just
Well, you've got the Radio 2 Book Club and your own podcast book off. Is it weird being on the other side?
Yes, it is, Robert, because I just feel like I need to ask you lots of questions rather than be answering them. But I think working for the BBC for so long and doing a little bit on air as well, and I, you know, I remember I co-hosted a show on Radio Berkshire for a while, and then as you say, doing my podcast, doing Book Off, which is in its 11th series now, I think, my goodness, it has helped, I think, being able to do interviews like this. I think it's helped me to know what is required of me, I suppose.
Now, you recorded the audiobook of Art is Everywhere, so before we start talking about it, let's have a listen.
When I first realised this, my mind was blown. I also thought that being an artist meant you had to be able to paint or draw. I thought an artist had a big canvas, a paintbrush, and was probably wearing a beret. How wrong I was about that too. So, I can make music and be called an artist? Yes, Joe. Or I could take up photography and also be called an artist? Yes. This discovery was pretty life-changing for me. Of course, we do call people who paint and draw and screen print and sculpt artists. But there are so many other people who are artists, and I'm going to tell you all about them in this book. I see artists as being sort of part of a big worldwide family, one which I'm very happy and privileged to be a member of, and which, by the end of this book, you may want to join too. Everyone is welcome.
Well, it's a book about the joy of creativity, looking at what it means to just be creative, whether that means you're writing or dancing or singing or acting or, you know, making visual art. It also looks at a lot of art forms that are out there. So I take an art form, maybe that's music, for example, a big passion of mine, and I do a sort of whole chapter on music and look at some of the brilliant artists who are making music who I admire. So each chapter focuses on three people who are, in my opinion, making brilliant art in that sort of genre.
So who are some of the people that feature in the book?
I could have put so many people in this book because I'm constantly in awe of, you know, artists who are making art. And I was going through a long list before I had to knuckle it down. And I was like, this person, this person, this person, this person. In the end, I think what I've done and what I hope I've done is chosen not only brilliant people who are really good at what they do or what they're known for in an artistic sense, but who also have other strings to their bow. So, for example, in the acting section of the book, I have the wonderful Russell Tovey, who I very much admire. And he is a brilliant actor, both stage and screen actor. And that's sort of what he's known for. But he also hosts a podcast called Talk Art. And he is a huge visual art fan, or art in general fan, and a big collector as well. And he's curated quite a lot of exhibitions over the last few years. So I chose him because of that. I chose Questlove, who is a drummer, one of my favorite drummers, who also has directed films. So he's directed an amazing documentary called The Summer of Soul. And he's also co-written a book. Rosie Jones is in it, the fabulous comedian who I absolutely adore and who is just a joy personified. And again, she is known for her comedy, but she has written books as well. So I think in the end, what I did was choose people who had more than just one thing that they were perhaps known for or do, so that I could show that you don't have to do one thing or be known for one thing, and that art actually is very fluid. So if you're a creative, you might like drawing, but you also might like writing, or if you're draw, you might like dancing, or if you like art, you might like acting. So that's how I sort of came to the people that are in it.
That full interview with Joe Harrell can be found in episode 328. And next up on our Read On look back at 2023, author Charlotte Levin. She first joined me in 2020 to talk about her first novel, If I Can't Have You, which was released at the height of lockdown. She returned in September of 2023 to talk about her new book, If I Let You Go, which is narrated by Maxine Peake.
These notes need to represent her properly, and nice ink is important. She'd hate to be remembered by the scrawls of a worn-out biro. Shuffling further back into the tall stool, she blinks, slow, heavy, and proceeds to write. Though all three notes differ in their content, each one opens with the same words. I am sorry.
It's about a woman called Janet Brown, and she's a kind of every woman, really. She's a cleaner from Salford, which is where I'm from. She's married to Colin, who is not the nicest person to her, and they're both grieving the loss of their daughter some years ago. And when Janet finds herself involved in a train accident, she takes an opportunity to make amends in some way for what has happened in the past. It's quite hard to discuss without giving things away.
It's a novel really about grief and redemption as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely. It's very much a sort of character-driven novel and about sort of moral dilemmas. Like my first book, I'm quite fascinated with the idea of good people kind of crossing boundaries and them still being kind of sympathetic characters.
So where did Janet actually come from?
Well, I had the idea for the concept of the novel, which involves things I can't talk about. And then I kind of worked backwards, which is what I do. It's like, who would that happen to and why? Why would someone do that? And sort of allow the reader to have an understanding of how they would do that. And even though the reader might not agree with behaviours, to kind of have an understanding. So I worked back and kind of got the character of Janet going backwards from that concept, really. The physicality and everything of Janet, the sort of character of Janet, came from when my mom was in hospital having an operation for her cancer. My aunt and I were cleaning her house to make it all nice for her return, and we were messing about, and my aunt tried on we're both dark haired, my aunt and myself. My mum was always blonde, and we tried on her chemo wig and a jumper that she had on, and my aunt looked so different that we were sort of laughing, and we gave this new person that she'd become the name Janet. And then fast forward years later, when I had the idea for If I Let You Go, the two kind of connected, and I thought, oh, that's who this character will be, that Janet. So it's almost like the seed had been planted many years prior for the actual character, even though I didn't have a story for her until that moment.
I thought that was going to go in a different direction there, actually, when you talked about cleaning, because Janet herself finds cleaning quite calming.
Yeah, I forgot about that connection, actually. Yeah, Janet's very not like me. She likes cleaning, and she's good at it. Yeah, I think she finds some kind of, it's that feeling of control, that she has some control in an environment where she is ultimately controlled and doesn't really have much control over her life.
Now, loneliness was a theme in your first novel. Do you think Janet, even though she's got Colin and Nish, and do you think she's a bit lonely herself?
I do, very, very much so. I mean, I think it's hard for Janet because she's sort of unable to form proper relationships because she can't sort of be entirely honest with people. And I think Nish is somebody who she definitely would form an even closer bond with, but there's always that distance. So I do think she is lonely. And it's weird, as a writer, you don't set out to write certain things, but there's obviously, I think subconsciously, there's themes and ideas that interest each individual author, and whatever the plot, whatever you're writing, they seem to come through the same kind of things.
Now, we won't talk much more about it because we will definitely get into spoiler territory, but you were first on the show in 2020 with If I Can't Have You. How was it being published when we were in lockdown?
Well, it was really very strange because obviously, like, when you're trying to get a book published and you're a writer, that whole journey is very long. You know, it was so exciting to happen. And then it was happening in the worst year, I think, ever to be a debut novelist. So, yeah, the whole thing was just not as it was supposed to be. But within that, other authors who were coming out in 2020, we set up a group, Polly Crosby did, another author, and we set up a group called the D20s. And that was just amazing because we were all in the same boat, which was a very weird boat that, you know, had never been experienced before. So we really bonded over that, and we're still, you know, a support group for each other now. So without that, goodness knows what it would have been like.
Now, If I Can't Have You, I remember you saying you spent years writing it. How was it writing If I Let You Go when you were on a deadline?
Yeah, well, it's a completely different process, which when you're trying to get your first novel published, you don't really think ahead that much. So it took it was 10 years from the first time I started writing, but then I rewrote the whole thing, and it was a good 5 years writing If I Can't Have You. And then suddenly you've got like a year to write the next one. And that includes coming up with the story, you know, the idea and everything. So it was a completely different process. And it was quite a stressful one because for the second one, there's always that doubt that the first one was a fluke, and you wonder whether you can actually do it again, especially in the time constraints. But now, I mean, I'm going through a similar thing with book three, where, you know, all the doubts are coming in, but I have to just trust the process now, remind myself that I felt like this with book two, and it does come together in the end. But it is very different to writing your first book.
She's invisible. A living ghost riding the number 73 bus through the streets of Salford. Crisp cotton blue top, light scrubs, ironed to perfection, the XL label cut out, and not just because it itched. All humanised by the name badge Janet. And, as always, a memorial to lost inner spark. Sparkly earrings, half moons bought by Colin many half moons ago. The fierce sun is a welcome break from the days of perpetual rain, and she rests her overheated head against the cool of the window to watch the daily rushes. Summer sky poking between penthouse-topped high-rises and poverty-stricken high-rises and red-brick daisy-chain houses as she nears home. All accented with colourful litter, pecked at by grey, hobbled pigeons.
And the title, If I Let You Go, could refer to a lot of things. Was that deliberate or does it actually have a meaning for you?
Not really. I mean, I didn't pick my titles for either, to be absolutely honest with you. I think they wanted to keep it in line with my debut novel. So we went through literally hundreds of titles. But because If I Let You Go does have sort of layered meanings that could be applied to the plot, that's what they decided to go with. And it you know, it can be interpreted in a number of ways, really, in terms of the plot.
Now we've had Samuel Stevens and now we've got Colin. Charlotte, yeah. What have you got against men?
I'm so sorry. Do you know what? I'm writing my third book. I've got a really, really nice man. And my writer, you're really struggling to write a nice man, aren't you? I don't know. Nothing, I promise you. But they're just quite fun to write, I think. Both Samuel and Colin were quite fun to write because they were both awful in different ways. I think Colin has some of the best lines in the book, even though he is the most awful. So I apologise for my terrible men writing.
Now, onto the writing. Do you prefer writing or do you prefer having written something?
Generally having written. I hate first drafts. Like, they are my nemesis. I can't stand doing first drafts. I love editing. So once I've got something, I can happily just get lost for hours and hours and hours, you know, making it work, making it land, rejigging the structure. But the staring at the blank page to me is actual horror. I really dislike it. So in terms of that, in terms of first draft, having written, but in terms of editing, I love the process. So writing, so a bit of both.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
To hear Charlotte talk about her novel, If I Let You Go, head to episode 336. And to hear her talk about her debut novel, If I Can't Have You, head to episode 184. Now, to end today's show, let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find two new gems.
HarperCollins has given us the distaff side of history in Normal Women by Philippa Gregory.
The invasion of England by the Norman army in 1066, Duke William of Normandy versus King Harold of England, would be far more than a regime change for the women of England. It was the hardening of a tyranny by men who captured the kingdom and its fortune, passed it father to son, excluding women, created laws enslaving women, composed religion and philosophy to denigrate women, men whose violence was directed at women and whose need for cash and greed for profit would underpay and overwork women for centuries. The account book, compiled to establish the value of lands for royal taxation, could be challenged no more than Judgment Day itself, and was named in the 12th century as the Doomsday Book. For the women of England, the Norman invasion was indeed a day of doom.
Normal Women is a radical reframing of our nation's story, told not with the rise and fall of kings and the occasional queen, but through social and cultural transition, showing the agency, persistence and effectiveness of women in society from 1066 to modern times. Did women do nothing to shape England's culture and traditions during 9 centuries of political turmoil, plague, famine, prosperity, religious reform? Philippa Gregory answers this question by telling stories of the soldiers, guild widows, highway women, pirates, miners, ship owners, international traders, theatre impresarios, social campaigners and female husbands who did much to build this fabric of our society, and in ways as diverse and varied as the women themselves. This is not another book about heroines. Instead, it is a book about millions of women, not just three or four. They went to war, tilled the fields, campaigned, wrote and loved. They committed crimes or treason, worshipped many times of gods, cooked and nursed, invented things and rioted. A landmark work of scholarship and storytelling, this is a history, not a call to action. It looks back at facts and the past lives of some 50% of the population without the judgmental eyes of the present.
William of Normandy was a notoriously aggressive leader who had already brutally conquered his homeland with a battle-hardened army. Their arrival marked the end of an England that had settled into relatively peaceful rule under Anglo-Saxon lords, inspired by a concept of good lordship, where women had legal rights, some owned land and their own fortune, ruled over their own tenants, could marry or separate freely, and could choose their heirs. A third of the surviving pre-conquest wills were written by women signing their own names. Winfled, grandmother of King Edgar, left a fortune on her death, around 950, and a special bequest to her daughter Ethelfled of favourite jewellery and an estate.
Her engraved bracelet and her brooch, and the estate at Ebsbourne and the title deed as a perpetual inheritance, to dispose of as she pleases. And she grants to her the men and the stock and all that is on the estate.
The men would have been the villeins, attached to the land with tenancy and employment agreements, the landless serfs who worked for free and were housed by the lord, and the slaves, who made up as many as 10% of the population, captured in war or purchased. They too were landless, unpaid and unfree, mostly white workers. Winfled ordered that her slaves be freed for the benefit of her soul, but two, highly skilled among them, a woman weaver and a seamstress, she left to her daughters. A cook, probably a slave, was left to her granddaughter, Eadgifu, who also inherited two chests, her best bed curtain, her best tunic and cloak, her old filigree brooch, and a long tapestry. Other children were to receive a red tent, a double badger skin gown, tapestries, bed linen, and books.
Normal Woman, 900 Years of Making History by Philippa Gregory, is read by Philippa Gregory with Claire Corbett, Tanya Rodriguez, Nenya Okoye, James Good, and Joe Jameson.
For those who like their history fictional, we have The Rebel Daughter by Miranda Mallins, which was given to us by Orion.
The dish slips from Betty's fingers and smashes on the flagstones. Somehow I keep hold of mine, and we stand frozen in shock, staring at the front door. A furious knocking thunders against the oak, and the street outside rings with angry shouts and shots. Instinctively, I wait for Father to push past us to the door before I remember that he is away fighting with his regiment. My brother Ollie, too. My oldest brother Robin lies in the cold ground, of course. Dick and Harry are off at school, and our groom, old Matthew, will be two jugs down at the bell now it has gone 9 in the evening. There are 8 women in the house, I realise with cold fear, and not a single man.
Ely, 1643. England is convulsed by civil war, setting king against parliament and neighbour against neighbour. As the turmoil reaches her family home in Ely, 19-year-old Bridget Cromwell finds herself at the heart of the conflict. With her father's star on the rise as a cavalry commander for the rebellious Parliament, Bridget has her own ambitions for a life beyond marriage and motherhood. And as fractures appear in her own family with the willful, beautiful younger sister Betty, Bridget faces a choice to follow her heart or to marry for power and influence and fight for a revolution that will change history.
Who is it? I venture forward, the dish of potatoes still in my hands. Mother emerges in the parlour doorway, and I glance sideways at her, hoping for reassurance. "Reverend Hitch," a familiar voice whispers thickly through the grained panels. "There has been an uprising in the town, mistress. You must secure the house. Put out your lights." Mother is beside me now, and has opened the door an inch to reveal the clergyman's pinched face. Over her capped head, I can just see townspeople scurrying through the dusk, their heads bowed. The Reverend is good to warn us, I think, for we are not always the most obedient of his flock, having a natural independence of religion. "Royalists?"
"Aye, mistress. About 50 of them have come out for the king. They've seized the gates and are working their way across the town. 6 of our parliament troops have been killed already. Another is bleeding out in the cathedral. You must make yourself safe. They will know this is Captain Cromwell's house and that he is from home. I must press on now."
"Lord have mercy."
Mother clutches at the single string of pearls at her neck.
"Thank you, Reverend. We are grateful. If you come across our groom in the town, please send him back here and ask him to bring any men that can be spared. We will barricade ourselves in and trust to God."
Reverend Hitch nods and hurries into the gloom, his black cloak flapping around his ankles. Mother closes the door and bolts it firmly. She turns to us, her face resolute, even as her hands fly out in a flurry of instructions. My heart pounds against my bodice.
"Betty, take Grandmother up to her room and see she has bread, small beer and blankets. Then go to the little ones. The knocking will have woken them, and they will be frightened. Dress them, in case we have to leave suddenly. Then sit with them. 1 candle only, put out the others."
The Rebel Daughter by Miranda Mullins is read by Karen Cass and runs for 10 hours, 56 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.